Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/theramblingravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are discussing Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, chapters 5 and 6, The Dementor, and Talons and Tea Leaves. In these chapters, Death Incarnate steps onto the train. Yeah. And we learn fortune telling has just as much criticism in the wizarding world as our own.
I'm really curious to talk to you about that chapter specifically. I know you read tarot, but beyond that, anything?
Well, again, the runes, and I do have my black crystal ball, and I have my other oracle decks. So yes, I do this stuff, but I think we've discussed off mic is that I tend to see these divinatory, like, fortune-telling practices more as a tool of self-reflection rather than actual divination of, like, predicting the future.
Okay. Yeah, I love, we'll talk about it a little bit more, but I was a little surprised at that kind of the reaction that several students and teachers had toward the divination class. But I'm sure we'll get there.
But first, we start off with chapter 5, The Dementor. Tom woke Harry the next morning with his usual toothless grin and a cup of tea. Harry got dressed and was just persuading a disgruntled Hedwig to get back into her cage when Ron banged his way into the room, pulling a sweatshirt over his head and looking irritable. And of course, the typical, you know, mad dash to get to the train station.
Yeah, that's kind of what a lot of this was. And also kind of like in that fervor, Harry trying to tell Ron what he overheard in the last chapter with his parents discussing his fate, I guess.
Yes, but he doesn't get an opportunity to do so until they're, like, fully on the train. But, you know, they head down to breakfast, and Mr. Weasley's reading the Daily Prophet, and one thing I noticed, Mrs. Weasley was telling Hermione and Ginny about a love potion she had made as a young girl. All three of them were rather giggly. And I just had a note here of, we see Hermione finally engaging in something somewhat more feminine.
That's very true. There are two instances in these chapters of kind of gender stereotypes. I don't remember the second one. I hope I highlighted it. But yeah, I thought that was a really interesting and kind of, it was, as you said, the first time we see that noted and kind of interesting. I don't know.
I think it says something that I think, you know, Hermione and Ginny throughout the series, like, as the books go on, it becomes apparent that they definitely have a sort of, like, girly relationship that, you know, just Harry and Ron are not privy to.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So, yeah. So I think as Ginny gets older and, you know, more experienced, you know, Hermione, I think they start to, like, confide in her and, like, maybe things she doesn't necessarily with the boys. And then we'll learn things about Ginny that not even Ron knows about, but Hermione knows.
And good for Hermione for keeping that circle of trust.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're all dashing to the train station. One thing I noticed is, you know, they have the ministry cars that are coming to pick them up. And I just, for whatever reason, I honed into the color of the cars and the suits, like they're green.
That's really funny that you noted that as well, because I imagined like a deep forest green. I don't know where that came from, but is that kind of, oh, it said dark green, but like I can see it in my head, the color that I envision. But
yeah, like I'm not quite thinking of an emerald or a forest. I'm thinking of something slightly lighter, like not necessarily like yellowish in. Yeah, like it's hard to describe what just normal, what green I'm thinking of. But yeah, just because I know, you know, green kind of in our sort of psyche for the last century or so has been associated, of course, with envy and, you know, greed with money. And then, but in like, even in the Renaissance and maybe even Victorian period, like green was a color that was associated with love.
Oh, that, and this is a yoga. And if we're talking about yoga, the heart chakra is green the little thing.
Yeah, exactly. I know you brought up the chakras, you know, in another episode. So yeah, I wanted just to get your thoughts because what just made me think of that is, again, you know, green being the color of love is the movie Bram Stoker's Dracula with Gary Oldman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He, when he plays Dracula, Mina Harker, like when he meets her, she's in this totally green Victorian ensemble. And I think it's trying to allude to that old school green associated with love.
That's really interesting. And that's really interesting how that's changed, because that is, maybe I'm a cliche or just it's easy, or maybe this is just my modern thinking, is when I was going through teacher training and learned about green being associated with the heart, I was like, wait a minute, what? So I think it's interesting to talk about it in connection with the Ministry of Magic, because I am assuming it is less that association and more the association with money, but not at all the association with Slytherin, because that's kind of my default when I'm thinking about Harry Potter and colors. And, you know, I kind of was like, are the robes specific to the house they would be in? And you said not necessarily. So, interesting dark green car choice.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I just honed in on that.
It made me go, interesting. So yeah. I picked up on it too.
And so they go into the train station or platform 9 3/4 in pairs, Mr. Weasley keeping Harry really close to him. And now Harry finally understands, oh, this is why he's watching me like a hawk.
And I think good on Mr. Weasley, who during this time, I think it's shortly after, he pulls Harry aside and's like, listen. And then Harry, and I think very wise beyond his years in this situation, is like, look, I just overheard you. It was probably the best way for me to find out about this information, because then nobody is kind of gave him the information that he shouldn't have. And I thought that was, I was like, well, how very positive of you, Mr. Potter, to take that approach. And then Mr. Weasley didn't have to give him the whole spiel and, you know, be put in kind of an awkward position.
Yeah. But the one thing is, like, Harry, promise me you won't go looking for Black. And Harry's like, what? Promise me, Harry, said Mr. Weasley, talking more quickly still, that whatever happens, why would I go looking for someone I know wants to kill me, said Harry blankly. Swear to me that whatever you might hear, Arthur quickly. So yeah, Arthur is totally an idiot. You do not plant this seed in a 13-year-old kid who is already prone to dangerous adventures.
It's so strange, because I picked up on that as well, and it's not the first time that somebody is like, look, Harry, don't go looking for this guy. So I just kind of took it as he kind of has a reputation of, I have to be the hero and I have to solve this problem. But planting the seed is maybe just don't.
Or maybe Mr. Weasley was presuming Harry knows something more than he does, because all Harry says is, I overheard you.
Right, right. That's a good point.
So, like, again, like, Harry makes this preemptive, it's okay, I know, you don't have to worry about breaking your word to Fudge, but maybe Harry's not privy to all of the facts that, from this conversation, Mr. Weasley thinks he is.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's something, I mean, that's kind of something I had to remind myself, and it's like, okay, he heard the conversation, but there was probably things that he did or didn't hear. I feel like I have that experience on a very smaller scale with some situations in workplaces where people tell me things that they shouldn't. I walked by a committee meeting, which they were not supposed to be holding without a staff person there, but which I would have been the staff person in attendance, and they were talking about me. So it was very awkward, and I was pretty upset by it. It wasn't necessarily flattering, and to be quite honest, I was very early on in my job and learning new things, but it didn't feel good. So I guess if I was going to walk by any conversation, Harry's way about it would have been preferable. So, or, you know, to kind of, it wasn't like, Harry, what an idiot. And it's not like these people were saying, Jess, what an idiot, but they were kind of talking about my lack of experience at the time. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Uncomfortable situations that, again, we can relate with Mr. Potter.
Indeed. And so, you know, they all get on the train. And so they're finally somewhat by themselves. And it's like, I need to talk to you guys. And Ron is just like, go away, Ginny.
I know. How rude. Like, it's not very nice.
And she's like, oh, that's, she goes away. But Ginny's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, good for her. Hopefully Jenny's going to come into her own here throughout the books.
Yeah. And so Harry spills the tea to Ron and Hermione.
Yes, he does.
But while spilling the tea, you know, they're sharing their compartment with the professor.
That was very odd. And this is the first time I believe we've had this happen in a compartment with them. I mean, obviously some of their conversations were very not, I wouldn't say not teacher friendly. That makes it sound like something, you know, I don't know, inappropriate, but you know, you probably conversations you wouldn't have with a professor.
Yeah, like this scene is kind of quoted of sleeping or not, like no teenager is going to divulge their secrets, no matter how superficial, in front of an adult like this.
I mean, I guess if you think that's going to happen, people are like, oh, you've never pretended to sleep before, you know, or just like, or the classic like dad thing, I'm just resting my eyes. Like I would be a little hesitant to any adult with some of this information. But given his name, I think he shares something with Mr. Sirius Black.
What do you mean by his name?
That his name is Professor Lupin, which I believe Lupus, Canis Lupus. Is that's a name for a dog or a wolf, I think. Lupine. I am not the linguist, but that was my best.
Yeah, like Luna is the, like, you know, word for moon. You know, we get ludicrous, like from the moon and all sorts sort of thing. Oh yeah, I should disclose to everyone listening is that so. At the end of our last episode, it clicked in Jess's mind that she finally remembered from pop culture that the big giant dog is Sirius Black and that he is a werewolf and that we are going to continue the show knowing that information.
Yes, I won't give away any of the other spoilers that I know or that I learned this weekend from my 11-year-old niece, but
yeah. So we've got Lupin here, and he's, again, as you said, the very first adult for them to see on the train, with the exception of, you know, the trolley candy lady.
Yeah, oh yeah, love her, just for her her gifts. And then they have this very, it's not like they're trying to be quiet. And I think the most interesting thing that occurs, you know, is his lack of response. He is just dead to the world, asleep. We're led to believe, because there's some shenanigans that happen that he doesn't really budge.
Yeah, like the sort of tension between Crookshanks and Scabbers, like doesn't wake up for any of that. And even Draco comes in at some point.
Yes, which he, that's kind of where we encounter our first Dementor, if I remember incorrectly.
Yeah, so yeah, well, first, this guy is dead to the world to the point that he didn't wake up with Crookshanks or Scabbers. He didn't wake up with when Draco came in, but not even Draco is stupid enough to like try anything right underneath a teacher's nose.
Right, because he could wake up at any point.
Yep, and then, but yeah, like Ron and Hermione are, you know, significantly more frightened of Black than he was. And I think, you know, part of it is just Harry, again, I'm Harry Potter, I've had to deal with this crap before. But I think a part of it, again, just he doesn't understand the magical context of this society that literally no one has ever, ever, ever escaped from Azkaban Fortress.
Yeah, it's like his newness to the wizarding world still is it's still, he's still a little green, I guess, in that regard, the seriousness.
Because I think he's thinking of Azkaban at this point still as a normal, quote unquote, jail rather than the House of Horrors it truly is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I agree 100%. He definitely doesn't seem as shook up, but I think later on he definitely gets a taste of what is Azkaban like.
Yeah.
But I guess before that, I totally jumped over the discussion of Hogsmeade and kind of how excited everybody is to go there, and then Harry sharing that doesn't get to go.
Yeah. Again, such a, you would think after all Harry's been through, he'd be like, you know, but he's still a 13-year-old boy and he's like, I want to go to the village on the weekend with my buddies, not supervised by teachers. And yeah, continue.
Oh, especially after he's had this kind of, like what we talked about, really nice week where he was by himself and able to kind of stroll about the streets and eat ice cream every day and do all that stuff. So I'm sure he does want to get a little bit of the village life on the weekend.
Yeah, and in a way, like maybe under normal circumstances, I would like to think that someone would have given him, if Sirius Black was not, you know, out running around, then maybe he could have used his I'm Harry Potter privilege to get sympathy from McGonagall or Dumbledore, because they know the situation at the Dursleys.
I think, I absolutely think he could have, but because of
the situation, it's the I'm Harry Potter, it's like, oh, we have to protect the Lord Savior, Jesus Wizard Boy.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, well, it's just they even try to wake Professor Lupin up at some point, and like Hermione's like poking him, just like, Professor.
This is like the first indicator to me that there is something more to this person than just a typical witch or wizard, because they really are. I mean, I feel like most people would
like,
wake up.
Is he drugged? Like, did he take a sleeping potion before he got on the train?
I think he has the post-night night out on the town sleeps or something. I don't know. But like, he's pretty out of it.
Did he do the walk of shame to King's Cross that morning?
I was thinking more like Howling at the Moon, but whoa. I don't know. I don't know. But I don't quite know what his deal is, but I'm, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, just having the trolley lady come, it made me think of all the delicious candies. And I remember we talked about, like, my favorite is the licorice wands.
Yeah, there was one that I was fairly interested in. I really like the idea of and this is at Honeydukes, which is the quills, the sugar quills, which you can suck on in class and think about what you're writing next.
The sherbet balls you suck on that make you levitate a few inches or feet.
I mean, sign me up. I think that sounds great.
Yeah. And then they specifically, you know, Harry's passing out the cauldron cakes to his buddies. And I'm thinking, like, to me, the ultimate cauldron cake would be like, it's a little cake cauldron, but it has a hauled out and just dump a scoop of ice cream in the middle of the little cauldron cake.
That sounds really good. I like that. That's really good. You got to throw a Harry Potter theme party some point.
Yeah. Well, there is that unofficial Harry Potter cookbook.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And then the first time ever, the train stops before getting to Hogwarts.
This was, so then it kind of, the cabin, I guess, kind of gets dark and people don't really know what's going on. And then it kind of turns into the kind of, seamless transition into apparently Harry's like fever dream.
And it's causing a lot of confusion. And even some other students like Neville and Ginny like come into the compartment because they're like, what's going on? And it's like, ouch, you stepped on my foot. Don't push me, all this. And then finally Lupin wakes up and is like, quiet.
Right. Yeah. Something does it. The darkness wakes him up. Like, how weird. But yeah, something finally gets him.
There was a soft crackling noise and a shivering light filled the compartment. Professor Lupin appeared to be holding a handful of flames. They illuminated his tired gray face, but his eyes looked alert and wary.
I don't know what this guy's deal is, but he's obviously seen some things. It sounds like if you have a gray face, it sounds like something.
Yeah. Standing in the doorway, illuminated by the shivering flames in Lupin's hand was a cloaked figure that towered to the ceiling. Its face was completely hidden beneath its hood. Harry's eyes darted downward, and what he saw made his stomach contract. There was a hand protruding from the cloak, and it was glistening, grayish, slimy-looking, and scabbed like something dead that had decayed in water.
Whew, but he doesn't see that for long. I'm just going to step outside here and ask a question. Do these have a face? Do Dementors have a face?
That will come up later.
Okay. Too much curiosity. Well, so this is kind of where the Dementor is floating by, and then Harry breaks out into a cold sweat.
Yeah, and the Dementor is like breathing as if trying to suck more than air from its surroundings.
Ooh.
It makes me think of like Darth Vader.
I'm not going to try to do the noise.
Again, my first thought was when I first read this book was either this is death or the Nazgul.
Tell me what that is, because I do not know.
The Nazgul are the 9 Ringwraiths in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay.
Remember those black hooded riders?
You know, I'm trying to
You're killing me here.
I have never read The Lord of the Rings, and the movies, it's just been way too long. So
yeah, but they're basically these sort of undead figures. They used to be 9 human kings, but now they like serve Sauron and like they chase Frodo to try and get the ring. But they're all black and they all wear hoods. And, you know, basically, you know, the Dementor is very much, with the exception of like the dead, like the sort of scabbed hand, like those are the hooded figure is very, very close.
Interesting. I will not ask that question, but interesting. I think that the effect that it has on Harry is I guess reason for mocking for some people later on, but it's something that freaks him out in a way that I don't think anybody has seen Harry freak out before.
Yeah, like it affects certainly everybody, but it seems as though Harry has been affected the most by it in the sense that he was the only one to fully pass out. Like the others started shivering or like, you know, a whole bunch of other things, but Harry is the only one to legitimately lose consciousness.
Yeah, and I think that's so new because it's like, oh, I'm Harry Potter, the Gryffindor, you know, I've got the touch by Voldemort, parsed tongue, all these things. And this is just the moment where it's like, oh, wow, this must be something very dark and has a heavy presence to knock Harry out like it does.
Yeah, and I'm curious, like, do you have any sort of memories of like passing out and feeling embarrassed by it?
So I went to Catholic school and I went to, and I'm old, I think we've already established that, but I went to, we didn't have AC in our church because we had to go to church. So it wasn't uncommon for kids to pass out. Gracefully, I was not one of those people, but I do remember watching kids pass out. Have you had a pass out experience?
Yes, I had a pass out experience in 7th grade where I was in choir, and I was not the first kid to pass out in this teacher's choir class. So I think she pushed us sometimes a little too hard and forgot to remind us to breathe.
I feel like she probably should have had somebody speak to her about that.
Yeah, so I was quote-unquote singing, and then I fell backward and passed out, and so I think my head landed in someone's lap, and they were an idiot and screamed and ran, like, away, so my head fell from their lap and hit the floor.
Oh my gosh.
Like, they couldn't, yeah, it was, like, it wasn't, like, really bad or anything. Just when I finally came around and woke up on the floor, you know, my head was, like, really hurt because the idiot couldn't just, like, slowly lower me to the ground.
Yeah. Kids.
And again, I wasn't the first one. At least I got off lucky because the last guy who passed out in her class did not fall backward like I did. He fell forward and smashed his head into the side of the piano.
Oh my gosh.
And so, yeah, like, mine wasn't that big of a deal, but, like, there were, like, 2 police cars and an ambulance.
That sounds like a big deal. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and it was just like once I came around and like walked in, I'm like, oh yeah, it's not like I'm normal because I'm not singing, you know, the breath out of my soul, so I'm okay now.
Right. If this choir teacher, wherever you are, come on. Like, stop making kids pass out. Also, to my old school, I hope you really have an air conditioner, because that is another horrible reason to have kids pass out because they're hot in church.
How are you supposed to meditate on the word of God when there's no AC?
I guess you are receiving the Lord's punishment by being overheated. I don't know. I don't know. Well,
is there any reason? Was it budget? Like,
I really don't know. You know, it probably was. That was probably the excuse. But I remember being let out of school early for heat days, quote unquote, because it would get so hot. But I hope to God they have an air conditioner now. I'll just say it wasn't my favorite place to be. So yeah, I have no idea. I have never been back, which would be weird. But I think that if I were to have this situation, and what you could have used as well is some chocolate that Professor Lupin is pushing.
Yeah, like I would love to use that as an excuse to get some of Lupin's chocolate.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Is this like the like pot brownie of Harry Potter world? Because it helps you feel better, right? After you.
I don't know. Like out. I like to think that it's some sort of magically enchanted chocolate that, apart from just being delicious, I'm sure it's enchanted to like release serotonin or dopamine or something.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought as well. Because he's just like, just eat this flipping chocolate, you'll feel better. It's like, okay, I didn't poison it. Eat the damn chocolate.
Yeah, and it's true that the minute Harry eats it, he feels better.
We should all be so lucky.
Yeah. So they finally get out into Hogwarts, and, you know, of course Draco's like, is it true, Potter? Did you faint? Did you actually faint? Is Longbottom telling the truth? And I'm thinking, Neville, why did you rat Harry out?
Yeah, come on, Mr. Longbottom.
I would like to think that Neville didn't intentionally do it. Maybe he was telling someone, like another Gryffindor, somewhere neutral, and maybe Malfoy overheard it.
I feel like, again, how I can relate to the Neville Longbottom in these books so far is I've had that, like, oh, I'm just trying to be like, oh my gosh, and Harry passed out. It was crazy. And it's like, what? And I'm like, oh, I didn't want you to hear that. Like, I feel like that's the situation.
Yeah. So they finally get in the horseless carriages up to the school, you know, like the little horseless buggies in the Disney's Haunted Mansion. That's one of my favorite rides.
Yes, I love the Haunted Mansion.
Yeah, I wish I could plan a trip to Disney World.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to stay at the Polynesian and just, like, do a theme park a day.
That would be, I would love to. I really want to check out Harry Potter World now. So now I've been in the world. But I we've talked about this. So I'll just check out Disney for 10 parts.
So, but before they can go into the Great Hall for the feast, you know, McGonagall calls over Harry and Hermione.
Yeah, kind of a strange duo. And I think the initial reaction is, what did we do? And I mean, because usually it would be Harry and Ron, but I feel like Hermione almost, and Harry even says, Professor McGonagall had a way of making feel like he must have done something wrong. And I know I've encountered teachers like that, where it's like, what did I do? I don't even know what I did, but what did I do?
That reminds me of Sound of Music. Have you seen that movie or play?
That is like my mom's favorite movie. So I've seen it at least once.
Okay. Well, it's just, you know, the main character, Maria, you know, she's a novice nun. And she's like, you know, when Sister So-and-so makes me, like, kiss the ground when I, like, say something inappropriate, now every time I see her, I just kiss the ground immediately just to save time.
Smart. Yeah.
But McGonagall isn't so much wanting to see Harry, but McGonagall brings him to Poppy Pomfrey, you know, the Mediwitch from the infirmary.
Yes, because
it's actually Poppy's like, oh, it's you. I suppose you've been doing something dangerous again.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like it's just in her schedule to like make time for Harry and his shenanigans. But
it was a Dementor, Poppy, said Professor McGonagall. Setting Dementors around a school, she muttered, pushing back Harry's hair and feeling his forehead. He won't be the last one who collapses. Yes, he's all clammy. Terrible things they are. And the effect they have on people who are already delicate. I'm not delicate.
I described myself as delicate last week, so I thought that was just pretty funny. But yeah. And then she's like, of course not.
You know, I've sort of embraced I'm a delicate, liberal snowflake, and that's okay because winter is coming.
That's great. Yeah, I'm right there with you.
So, yeah, so Harry is just totally not here for this, like, fussing over him because he already feels bad enough. And when they suggest that maybe he should stay overnight in the hospital wing, he's like, no!
Right. He kind of, he throws a little attitude there and then he's
And Poppy's like, okay, then at the very least, he needs some chocolate. And he's like, I've already had some. Professor Lupin gave me some. Did he now, said Madame Pomfrey approvingly. So we finally got a defense against the dark arts teacher who knows his remedies.
That was a very interesting statement because it made me think of Gilderoy Lockhart, who we talked about a lot, who just had no idea. So this was refreshing that that truly was the consensus of the powers that be remedy for that situation. And it was addressed immediately by Professor Lupin. So
yeah,
good on him.
He didn't just help the aftermath. Like, he drove the Dementor away with like the magic white mist thingy.
Yeah. And then he, I think I know what that is, by the way. Also sent an owl to just give Poppy Pomfrey a heads up and say.
So clearly, as bedraggled as he looks, Professor R.J. Lupin is on top of his shit.
Good on him. Finally. Finally. We have somebody other than Dumbledore who's got it together.
Yeah.
And McGonagall.
And then so McGonagall sends Harry away, but she keeps Hermione behind to talk to her privately.
Yes, because
what do you think this is about?
Well, I guess for some reason, bits and pieces, I know she has a little device where she's stacked her schedule and she's wanting to take, she apparently registered for like every class and she's sorting that out with McGonagall.
What is this little device?
I feel like, what is it called? A time turner? Is it that?
Ding, ding, ding.
Okay. Okay. I don't. It's on the cover of the copy of this book I have too, but
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like the editions that you showed me, like on Instagram and stuff, it's like you're gonna know everything by these covers, man.
Yeah, they do give a lot away, don't they? And yes. Anyway, so I do know that. I'll save my other thing that I think I know for off mic, but
yeah. So Hermione, as we know, gets squared away with her little time turner to, you know, do her classes. And they finally get to the feast, but regrettably, they've missed the sorting again. So no sorting hat song for us.
Thank God. I mean, oh, that's too bad.
It's not the Hogwarts, like, anthem that was really stupid in book one, but I did like the sorting hats, like, poem.
That's the one I didn't like, is the sorting hat song, but the little anthem, that was pretty silly.
Yeah. So they get to the feast and Professor Dumbledore is, you know, stands up and is like, welcome. Welcome to another year at Hogwarts. I have a few things to say to you all as one of them is very serious. I think it's best to get out of the way before you become befuddled by our excellent feast. As you will all be aware, after the search of the Hogwarts Express, our school is presently paying host to some of the Dementors of Azkaban, who are here on Ministry of Magic business. He paused, and Harry remembered what Mr. Weasley had said about Dumbledore not being happy with the Dementors guarding the school. They are stationed at every entrance on the grounds, Dumbledore continued, and while they are with us, I must make it plain that nobody is to leave the school without permission. Dementors are not to be fooled by tricks or disguises or even invisibility cloaks, he added blandly, and Harry and Ron glanced at each other. It is not in the nature of a Dementor to understand pleading or excuses. I therefore warn each and every one of you to give them no reason to harm you.
Yeah, it kind of calls out Ron and Harry there a little bit with the invisibility cloaks, but that's
and cool. He's calling out the very essence of Dementors, and it kind of begs the question of, is it worth having these super dangerous creatures around children just to capture one escaped convict?
I guess they're trying, my perception is the level of evil that this person, that Sirius Black is, that, you know, he's killed 13 people with this curse, that he's such a horrible guy that they need these horrible guards to protect basically Harry and the kids. And I'm making that distinction because Harry and I'm assuming the rest of the adults know, he's specifically targeting Harry. That's the level of protection they need. So I don't know. It sounds pretty awful.
Yeah, and it kind of begs the question of, you know, again, Dumbledore really doesn't like the Dementors, and so we're kind of supposed to infer from that, from all, and again, you're a Dumbledore lover, so that if Dumbledore really doesn't like them, then they're really, really bad news. And so it just begs the question of these Dementors, are they truly, like cognizantly, like, malicious, and it's like, ha-ha, I'm twirling my mustache under my cloak and gonna do evil deeds? Or are these just simply a creature who cannot help being the way that it is? Just as like a giant wildcat could not act in any other way besides be a wild animal.
These things sound pretty evil to have made a choice to be this way, but I don't know. I'm very curious about the Dementors because they are very, very gothic in my mind. So
yeah.
I want to learn more.
So we don't really know the exact origins of the Dementors, deep Harry Potter trivia. What we know is that basically Azkaban Fortress was based, that island was ultimately found. I think maybe in the 15th or 16th or 17th century. And so the wizards go in there and there's this fortress castle there. And the things in there were so horrible. And one of the least horrible within that castle was the Dementors.
Wow. So
there was shit in that place that was even worse than the Dementors.
Wow.
And they just decided to keep the Dementors as like there and make it into the prison because they didn't know what else to do with them.
Makes sense, I guess. Makes sense. Crazy.
Yeah. But yeah, so we get that little warning from Dumbledore, and then Dumbledore goes on to announce that Lupin is filling the post of Defense Against the Dark Arts professor.
Yay, good for him. And then Hagrid is the magical creatures teacher. So finally. Yay. So
and now it makes sense why that book was assigned.
Right. Exactly. And they kind of come to that conclusion as well, which I love how they treat the book in the next show. Yeah. They're pretty excited for him too.
Yeah. Because right before they announce Hagrid, Snape is looking at Lupin with complete and utter loathing.
I feel like that's kind of Snape's face sometimes, though. He's always like annoyed.
Like, I don't know what we're supposed to infer, because Harry's kind of interpreting it is that he always knew that Snape wanted the Defense Against the Dark Arts job, but this looks even worse. It's like he's looking at him the way he looks at me. So I know this is the ultimate of hatred.
Yeah, so something, there's some beef there, apparently.
Maybe. And then they have their feast and they go up to the little Gryffindor Tower, and that is the end of chapter 5.
Get on chapter 5, Dementor.
The Dementor, one of the most iconic creatures of the franchise.
Yeah, they're pretty cool looking. I mean, the depictions that I've seen are pretty cool.
So. Yeah, like there is huge debate in the fandom. Like in one camp, people's favorite Harry Potter movie is The Prisoner of Azkaban. And for some, it's the absolute least favorite.
Really?
And I think this comes from, it's all about like what you value. And I really like Prisoner of Azkaban because it got a different director than the first and second. And so he went all out horror gothic with the cinematography. And again, how he depicted the Dementors was great. But a lot of people, despite all that brilliant cinematography, really harp on how much he sacrificed plot-wise.
Oh.
As an adaptation of a book.
I need to watch the book. I really want to.
Watch the book?
Watch the book. Yeah, I'm reading the book, so I really need to watch the movie, but I'm trying to hold off on some of this. So I don't, I'm definitely not going to watch this movie until after this one. I'm most intrigued because of probably the gothic-y horror elements even thus far.
Alrighty then. And now we move on to chapter 6, Talons and Tea Leaves.
Yes.
And Draco is still harping about the fainting thing.
Yeah, which we learn a little bit from somebody that Draco
like Fred and George.
Yes, that Draco had the same reaction pretty much as Harry. He was really freaked out.
Like, he probably didn't pass out, but he was, again, terrified.
Yes, yeah. So do they use this information against him later on? I don't know, but they definitely have that information. We also learned that the first Quidditch match is Gryffindor versus Slytherin. So
I think that's how it always is.
Is it? It feels like there was always a Slytherin Gryffindor showdown at some point, but
yeah, but yeah, Slytherins aside, they get their schedules.
Yes, and this is where we learn that Hermione is basically taking every class, and Ron kind of reads her schedule out. So he says, see this morning, 9 o'clock, divination, and underneath 9 o'clock, muggle studies. And Ron leaned closer to the schedule, disbelieving, look, underneath that, arithmancy. I hope I said that right. 9 o'clock. I mean, I know you're good, Hermione, but no one's that good. How are you supposed to be in three classes at once? And she just kind of dismisses it. She's like, it's probably be fine. It'll be fine. Like, yeah, don't worry
like,
about it.
Honestly, like, now I've gone through, like, college and stuff, she could have just said that I'm taking the classes, but because of the time conflict, I'm doing an independent study with these teachers.
There you go.
Like, that's all, like, that's all she could have said to, like, shut them up.
Right. I'm like concerned about her workload. That's what I'm concerned, because I'm guessing most of her schedule is similar to this. Like, she's got three classes across the board at whatever hours.
Yeah, because, well, let's see. Okay, it's Defense Against the Guards, like Potions, Herbology, Charms, Transfiguration, Prayer of Magic Creatures, Divination, Arithmancy, Ancient Runes, Muggle Studies. At least 10 subjects.
That's a lot. It's a lot. I could not handle that.
Yeah, because, like, because usually in, you know, in, like, school, like, in college at the undergraduate level, if you're on a semester system, you know, the most students take 4 or 5 courses and 6 okay. if you're really, really ambitious.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was kind of like I one semester took 6, and that's when I was just trying to wrap things up. I feel like that's when I was just like, let's get this over. And that was a lot. So Hermione, girl, you're out of your gourd. That's what I think.
And so they try and make their way to divination. And it's a bit out of the way. They've never been to the North Tower before. And they're kind of lost. And who do they meet? One of my favorite paintings in all of Hogwarts, Sir Cadogan.
Okay. So there was this little battle kind of scene within the scene of in the painting of the knight. And his help for the kids to get to the class.
And it's like, a quest! And he's like, come follow me, dear friends, and we shall find our goal, or else shall perish bravely in the charge.
Love the drama. Love the drama.
Yeah, so he's hopping from painting to painting and ultimately leads them into North Tower, where a little silver rope ladder drops from the trapdoor. Which I think this is a pretty cool setup for your classroom.
Yeah, it is. This is Professor Trelawney, right? So they're going to divination. It's quite the way to get there. We got the paintings, we got the rope. It's a little intense way to get to a class, but it's pretty cool.
Yep. And so they go through the trapdoor. He emerged into the strangest looking classroom he had ever seen. In fact, it didn't look like a classroom at all. More like a cross between someone's attic and an old-fashioned tea shop. At least 20 small, circular tables were crammed inside, all surrounded by chintz armchairs and fat little poofs. Everything was lit with a dim crimson light, and the fire was burning under the crowded mantelpiece was giving off a heavy, sickly sort of perfume as it heated a large copper kettle.
Sounds cool to me. I mean, I don't know. It sounds very much like what she's in for. I mean, to teach basically fortune telling, to call it the basic term, I guess.
Welcome. How nice to see you in the physical world at last.
Sorry.
Welcome to divination, said Professor Trelawney, who had seated herself in a winged armchair in front of the fire. My name is Professor Trelawney. You may not have seen me before. I find that descending too often into the hustle and bustle of the main school clouds my inner eye.
Okay, her name is Trelawney. Sorry, I pronounced that wrong. And I already love this character because I know some people that are like this in real life. So this is kind of fun.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, you know, Kevin, you know, and Fox and the Foxhound podcast, he has not, you know, he's a little less spoiled than you. And so, like, when he makes predictions about what's going to happen next in the books, like, they call that section the Professor Kevlani section.
Oh, That's cute. I like that.
Yeah. Many witches and wizards, talented though they are in the area of loud bangs and smells and sudden disappearings, are yet unable to penetrate the veiled mysteries of the future. Which I didn't think about it before, but the way I read that, it kind of reminds me of Snape.
It's very Snape-like, and I think, and I don't, you know, work in academia, but sometimes I kind of get the impression of a little bit of snobbery on in this, you know, these fools don't know divination. What a bunch of ding-dongs. They can't really get to that level. Whereas we learn later on, some of the other professors at Hogwarts are like, what is this lady doing? She's out of her mind, you know, with this divination stuff, which is not even legit. So I think, you know, we've touched on that a little bit, but I think it's interesting to kind of see that, what's the word, conflict among subject matters at the school that I don't think I've seen or read about before.
And I think it's also just by the nature of it being a school and dealing with kids, kids are more easily impressed by the bells and whistles of the explosions, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so professors like Trelawney and Snape, whose their subject matter is significantly more subtle.
Yes.
You know, and Snape is all like, you know, I doubt you, and many of you will think this is actually true magic.
Right, right. This is, I guess I'm naive, but I think when I started reading about magical things, this was what I thought, you know, was kind of like the height of magic was divination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that she goes on to say, like, we'll begin with reading tea leaves and go on to palmistry and other things. And so ultimately she gets them into drinking tea so that they can read each other's tea leaves.
She's also kind of like throughout this predicting different students' future, you know, like, you know, I think Lavender Brown is her name. She's worried about something. And then she says, it will happen Friday the 16th. Oh, it says, incidentally, that thing you've been dreading, it will happen Friday the 16th of October. I just thought that was kind of funny how she was just kind of like.
And then she says, by Easter time, one of our number will leave us forever.
Yeah, which really trips all the kids out.
And again, predicts Neville that he's going to break the china.
Yeah, and then he does. And
again, we got to beg the question of, is Trelawney truly working within her craft, or is she just really good at reading people in that sort of charlatan con artist way, or is it a bit of both?
That, I think, is always the question with some of these situations and some of the some people in the real world that practice divination. So I don't know.
Yeah. So they get to reading their tea leaves and Ron is like, you know, there's a cross here that means you're going to go through suffering. But then there's the sun. So you're going to suffer, but you'll be happy about it.
I do like the kind of contradictions and, you know, when you're reading things, because I think it's hard. And I had once heard that tarot is incredibly difficult to learn. And some of these divination things are difficult to learn because you do read these contradictory things. And then, you know, they're looking at these tea leaves. And they're making little jokes at Trelawney's expense. And then they get to Harry's teacup and they think the blob is a bowler hat, or it's a, like, you know, a bear or something. I don't know. Or a hippo. That's what it was.
Yeah. And then Professor Trelawney looks into the teacup and is like, the falcon, my dear, you have a deadly enemy. But everyone knows that, said Hermione in a loud whisper.
This is kind of like the first instance, or maybe one of the few instances that Hermione is kind of, you can tell she doesn't respect Trelawney just by her reaction to this, which is kind of interesting.
And I'm just thinking, like, why is Hermione so triggered by Professor Trelawney?
That's a great question.
But it's one thing that it's like, oh, maybe this isn't a subject I'm super really interested in, like, you know, and just keeping your mouth shut and quietly, it's like, oh, okay, whatever. But she cannot help but try and contradict her.
Yeah, she's, I mean, it's almost jarring to read that and see Hermione's name attached to it, because it's, she really does not feel good about her.
Yeah, because, like, it's to a point, it's like Professor Trelawney threatens like her entire analytical view of the world.
Yes. Yes. That is, you know, and I did think about that too, is kind of that intuition, feeling all those things. And Hermione is very much, you know, the book says this, the answers are at the library. So I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's challenging the things that she thought she knew.
Yeah. And I think it's also like kind of another stake in the coffin of why Hermione is a Gryffindor and not Ravenclaw, because Sybil Trelawney is a Ravenclaw.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So again, the whole notion of wisdom in the Ravenclaw's definition of knowledge and pursuit of knowledge is not purely analytical memorization the way Hermione goes about it.
Right. Excellent point.
So, and then Trelawney's like she screams and is like, no, right. It's so terrible. Don't tell me. Don't tell me. You know, you really want me to tell you.
Yeah. Right. 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 She's creating quite the scene.
And she says it's the Grim, like the big black dog. It is the worst omen of death.
So this is kind of where Trelawney, I think, freaks out Harry. And I guess readers new to Harry Potter to kind of, you know, she seems like she's full of it, kind of. I think Hermione's doubt sows some doubt. But then it's like, oh, yeah, there was this big black dog. Do I think it's an omen of death? I mean, Harry sure does, because he's thinking about the book cover. He's thinking about all these things. And, you know, and then Hermione dismisses her again. But it really kind of shakes up Harry for sure.
Yeah. I don't think it looks like a grin, said Hermione flatly. Professor Trelawney surveyed Hermione with mounting dislike. You'll forgive me for saying so, my dear, but I perceive very little aura around you, very little receptivity to the resonances of the future. She's not wrong.
No,
Hermione is showing that she's not receptive to this, you know, way of magic or this way of thinking.
Right. Which I think that...
which, I don't know, like, what was, by the pure name of the class, divination, what was Hermione expecting?
I wondered the same thing myself, because, you know, we've talked about her stacked schedule. What was she just like, I want to take this class so I can criticize it, or,
no, like, you know, honestly, more, I want to take all the classes just to say that I did.
Maybe like, that's her.
Because it's just really, again, really stupid, like, or maybe Hermione again thought that, you know, from what we're seeing, you know, this is a very stereotypical, Trelawney has all of the trappings of a Muggle world's conception of divination and fortune telling. And so I think maybe Hermione was thinking, you know, obviously that's just a stereotype. That's not what it's really going to be like. And then she shows up and it's like, oh, it's the same here too. And it's dumb.
Well, and I don't know if there's any discussion outside of this. Because obviously in the Muggle world, people do read fortunes and tea leaves and do all these things. Are we led to believe that those are sometimes actually true wizards and witches out in the Muggle world making living? Or is it just all BS Muggles just trying to
Probably a combination of both.
Interesting.
And then soon after that, the class is dismissed and they go on to Transfiguration and they're discussing animagi, wizards who can transform at will into animals.
Yeah, this part
relevant later.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yes. I think this was cute because I think McGonagall is very kind of straight laced and whatever, and she does this cool thing and there's no reaction. And she's like, what's going on with you all?
Not that it matters, but that's the first time in my Transfiguration class to not get applause.
Right. And then she kind of says, or somebody says, please, Professor, we've just had our first divination class and we're reading the tea leaves. And she says, of course, said Professor McGonagall, suddenly frowning. There's no need to say any more, Miss Granger. Tell me, which one of you is going to be dying this year?
And me, said Harry, finally. I see, said Professor McGonagall. Then you should know, Potter, that Sybil Trelawney has predicted the death of one student a year since she arrived at this school. None of them have died yet. Seeing death omens is her favorite way of greeting a new class. If it were not for the fact that I never speak ill of my colleagues, even though I'm totally speaking ill of my colleagues.
100%.
Divination is one of the most imprecise branches of magic. I shall not conceal from you that I have very little patience with it. True seers are very rare. You look in excellent health to me, Potter, so you will excuse me if I don't let you off homework today. I assure you that if you die, you need not hand it in.
She's got jokes today, Professor McGonagall.
Although at least it's, you know, Professor showing her kind of disdain and contempt for divination as a subject, but at least she's admitting, I don't have the patience for it.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to say. Like, you know, I can't be a ferret. There are people that I work with that I have just resolved to say, I cannot give her a fair assessment because I have my own, you know, thoughts and feels that are informed by whatever. So it is good that.
And again, so Hermione is very much a younger version of McGonagall, like, who is really smart. But again, McGonagall is not Ravenclaw. She's Gryffindor and the head of Gryffindor House now.
Right. That's a great. Hermione and McGonagall, I didn't really put them together until now, and that makes a lot of sense.
So Harry felt a little bit better. It was harder to feel scared of a lump of tea leaves away from the dim red light and befuddling perfume of Trelawney's classroom.
Well, good. I'm glad he feels better at this point.
And, you know, they finish and they go to lunch, and Ron's still kind of thinking about it, because, again, he's more steeped in this wizarding culture than Hermione, so he's not as quick to dismiss it. Not that he has anything for or against Trelawney, and he's just like, you haven't seen a black dog anywhere, have you? Yeah, I have. And Ron freaks out.
Well, I was kind of, you know, all of last book, Harry kind of had this like secret that he wasn't telling anybody. So at first I thought, are you not going to say anything, Harry? And then luckily he does say something about it. And then this kind of spurs the Ron and Hermione butting heads they butt heads before, but this is something that really, you know.
Yeah, and so Hermione's constantly trying to dismiss it as coincidence and it's not really a death omen and that people, it's just self-fulfilling prophecies. And Ron finally snaps back, Professor Trelawney said you didn't have the right aura. You just don't like being bad at something for a change.
that really pissed her off.
Yeah, really. And it's true. It's like, and it begs the question, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Does Hermione hate divination because she's bad at it, and therefore she doesn't want to admit that she's bad at it, so she just wants to completely negate the legitimacy of the entire subject?
I think that you kind of nailed it earlier when it was like she's very logical thinking, and this is kind of beyond her comfort. So she's really struggling with trying to. I don't know how receptive she'll be to this later, but I don't know if she's necessarily bad at it. I think she just doesn't even accept it. So she doesn't, you know, she can't really.
It's like she doesn't even try.
Right. She just dismissed it. It's like somebody that you don't like telling you their favorite band is this. And you're like, well, I'm sure it sucks because you suck or something like that. I don't know.
Yep. And though they get after lunch, Ron and Hermione still aren't speaking to each other. And they make it down to Hagrid's hut for his first ever Care of Magical Creatures class.
Very excited that this is his class. I also love that, you know, the book, which now thinking about it, of course, the Monster Book of Monsters would be assigned by Hagrid, but he treats them like, well, you've got to basically stroke their spine to calm them down, like you ding dongs. And then, of course, that is the trick.
Harry, again, is apprehensive because he knows Hagrid's reputation with magical creatures and assessing their danger,
right,
value or whatever. And but it's not giant spiders, it's not dragons, it is hippogriffs.
These are pretty cool critters, very
sensitive.
Have you
ever come across them in literature or anything else before?
I have not. The original, I believe, the original cover of this book has him riding a hippogriff. But
yes, it does. Like, that's what's on my my U.S. hardcover edition from my childhood.
Okay. Yes, I remember seeing that. But beyond that, now that I think about it, I believe I've seen that image, but I'm trying to figure out if it's related to Harry Potter or not. Is it something that's Is that like a mythological creature?
It is a mythological creature, and it's supposed to be the... It's come up in old school poetry and stuff. It's supposed to be the product of the mating of a griffin and a mare. Like, the symbolism of something very unlikely happening, the fact that a predator and a prey, like, mated and created something else.
Interesting. Okay.
But I would definitely say with confidence that Harry Potter definitely brought the hippogriff sort of back in sort of mainstream fantasy as a, you know, typical creature. But again, but it has existed in poetry, like, you know, centuries before.
Okay. Interesting. Well, they're very, I can relate a lot to the hippogriff because they're very sensitive. They don't like to be insulted. So that's kind of the little tidbit that Hagrid, you know.
So Harry, who's desperate for his class to go well, even though he's apprehensive, climbs over the paddock and tries bowing to the gray hippogriff Buckbeak.
Buck. I know. Well, he's going to show up a couple times, I'm pretty sure. So.
And Harry bows. And finally, Buckbeak bows back and he's able to pet him. And he's like, great, now you can ride him now.
That's pretty cool. Just climb up on him in, what does he say, just behind his wing joint. And
yeah, so Buckbeak takes Harry for a little bit of a spin, although Harry's not enjoying it that much because he prefers his broom. But honestly, I prefer dragons or hippogriffs any day.
Yeah, I would too. Broom's kind of boring when you have something you can kind of like chat with. Not really, not that it's going to talk back, but you know, I like critters more than I like brooms anyway, so...
Yeah. Cool. Now, I know this just made me think of, because, you know, I used to ride horses, and somehow my book club, we were talking about, you know, I was comparing something in a book to, like, the snobbery in one sport to the snobbery in, like, horseback riding, where, you know, there's, like, Western riding, where, you know, they do rodeos and stuff, and, you know, and the saddles are different, because in Western riding, you have the saddle horn to hang on to.
Oh, okay, okay.
And then, but in English riding, which the horseback riding I used to do, like, there's a saddle, but there's, you know, no big saddle horn. There's nothing, like, to hold on to. And one of my book club ladies was like, then how do you stay on? And I'm like, with your legs, with your thighs. That's why your legs get so toned.
Yeah. I didn't know that about the different saddles. That's interesting. Yeah. I've ridden horses, but maybe twice in my life.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, but this is riding bareback. Yeah, I would have definitely needed a saddle on Buckbeak.
Yes, yeah, Buckbeak's pretty cool though. I think that kind of inspires the rest of the class to want to take a go at riding Buckbeak.
Yeah, so you know, some of them get with the Palomino. One, Ron and Hermione get the chestnut hippogriff, and Malfoy has taken over Buckbeak,
the idiot who was not listening and just, you know, horsing around with his friends, because we already know he does not respect Hagrid at all. So, and he pays for it. He pays for not listening.
Yeah, this is very easy. I knew it must have been if Potter could do it. I bet you're not dangerous at all, are you? He said to the hippogriff. Are you, you great ugly brute? And ultimately, Buckbeak just totally, you know, slashes his arm.
I don't feel sorry for Malfoy at this point. I mean,
no,
he was
no, you're not supposed to feel sorry for him.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm dying. I'm dying. Look at me. It's killed me. And,
oh,
and I love
God.
How Tom Felton, like, he's like, oh, it's killed me. It killed me.
It's drama. Now, I do feel sorry for Hagrid. And I think Harry.
Yeah.
I guess the
question is, you know, reading this as an adult, I think more, of course, you know, Malfoy is the bad guy and you want bad things to happen to him and not have the good guys punished. But trying to think of it objectively as an adult, you know, if you were assessing, you know, Hagrid's teaching ability, you know, as an adult, I think about how culpable is Hagrid, if at all, because yes, definitely, Hagrid gave them very explicit instructions. Do not insult them. They are very proud. But at the same time, these are 13-year-olds who inevitably one of them's going to not listen.
Yeah, I thought about that as well. It's because you can kind of fault Malfoy for not listening. But also, Hagrid kind of beats himself up too. Like, I shouldn't have started with that. But he also kind of wanted to get people excited about his class. So it's a hard thing to, I mean, I just think of all the dumb stuff that kids do, and you know.
Yeah, like one thing, like one dumb thing I did was we were doing archery in PE, and of course there were very specific times where the woman, you know, my PE teacher would say, you know, take aim, and you weren't allowed to let go or fire until, you know, she said so. But there was one instance where I was just getting into the zone and I'm just like, okay, time to shoot my next bolt. And I just shot it without her saying. And again, I wasn't trying to be a rebel or stupid right. or dumb. It just happened.
I think, yeah, you know, I think that that's the interesting thing about this creature. And, you know, I think that you're right. I mean, that's kind of to be expected with kids, but it's basically asking, Hagrid's basically like, don't be a dick for like 5 minutes. Don't call this thing ugly, you know, be decent. And I guess that to me, this is almost just saying like, that is so impossible for Malfoy that this hippogriff is just gonna just kind of attack him. So
yeah, it's even, you're right. It definitely, it's not even the sense of, it's a very complicated instruction for this creature that they just have been exposed to and know nothing about. It's not like, oh, you have to pet it this way or that way. Like, it's not even a very technical, like, sense of caring for the creature. It's just literally, don't insult it.
Right.
That's all they had to do.
It's like you had one job, you know, like I think about the instances at work where I listen to people have word salad or, you know, something like that. And I'm like, okay, what did you want me to do? This was not that situation. It was like, you got to do this. And oh, by the way, don't insult it. I personally don't think that's a bad rule for life dealing with any witch, wizard, muggle creature. Just maybe don't insult the thing. But, so could Hagrid have taken it down a notch? Sure. But I don't,
for Hagrid, this was taking it down a notch compared to his other crap.
That is 100% true. That is 100%
true. I'm sure Dumbledore had a sort of talk with him about, you know, you are a, you know, big guy, you can handle things the way the kids can't. So, you know, like for Hagrid, he did a really good job of toning it down from his usual self.
Right. I think so. He probably really did think this was a pretty safe choice, but I think he should have taken Malfoy to the side and be like, listen, maybe you're going to sit this one out because I just don't trust your mouth. I don't know.
Well, I think it's more not that Hagrid doesn't know his subject or maybe what's appropriate for their age. I think Hagrid, just by the nature of him kind of being an outcast and, again, not probably having the most socialization, like not taking into consideration, again, that Malfoy is going to be a dick to this degree just because he doesn't like Hagrid.
Right.
But, yeah, so Hagrid carries off Malfoy. And, you know, Harry, Ron, and Hermione ultimately decide, you know, after dinner and everything, that they're going to go down and visit him and try and see how he's doing. And, of course, Hagrid's been drinking.
Yes. Come on, Hagrid. Get it together. But he's worried. He thinks that this is going to be a record, that the first teacher they've ever had who basically didn't even, well, lasted a day, if that.
Yeah.
But he hasn't been fired yet.
Yeah, and Harry, Ron, and Hermione reassure him that, like, we'll be witnesses. You gave very clear instructions, blah, blah, blah. And Hagrid starts to feel a little better and dunks his head in a barrel of water, I guess, to sober up.
I guess. That's okay. That's pretty funny.
And, again, just shows, again, because Hagrid's not the great at socialization, like, the kids have to be a mother to him. And Hermione's like, I think you've had enough to drink, Hagrid.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty...
But when he does sober up and he's looking at Harry and he's realizing that these three kids have come and visited him after dark, and he just stands up all of a sudden and is super mad.
To the point where this is written in all caps, what he's saying to the kids. I think hopefully that reflects the level of severity. I mean, we've got freaking dementors guarding the castle and he's basically like, what are you doing here? Get the hell back to the castle. You can't have been here. You're, I mean, basically this is bad. So go away.
And it's like, and you too, let Nip. And it's like, they're kids too.
Right. The kid logic is still there right now.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's very much just the nature of, again, no one's broken out of Azkaban before. So it begs the question that if you can break out of Azkaban, you can break into Hogwarts.
Right, right. Yeah, it's pretty severe. This is not a situation where anybody is messing around. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Come on, said Hagrid angrily. I'm taking you all back up to school and don't let me catch you walking down to see me after dark again. I'm not worth that.
Aw, Hagrid.
You are worth it, Hagrid.
You're worth it, buddy. Yes.
Hashtag reinstate Hagrid.
I'm right there with you. I will support that.
And that concludes chapter 6, Talon and Tea Leaves. A lot. It was super long. Each of the chapters were like 45 minutes apiece.
I believe it. I reading it, it was just like it kept going. I was like, wow, this is pretty lengthy for the HP book this go round.
Alrighty then. Pretty obvious for Gothic Geek Out.
How can you not call the Dementors the most gothic element? It's just to the point where I just think they're so cool and interesting. And I kind of was thinking about this today and I thought it's kind of like a moving haunted house, you know, kind of the oppressive, heavy feeling and the ambiance that you get in a gothic novel. That is a Dementor. I'm assuming that's yours too, but I don't know.
Of course, that is the Dementor. And again, I struggle with how, if I were to objectively put Chamber of Secrets and Prisoner of Azkaban on each side, they're both quite gothic, but in their different ways. Because they're both appealing to different niches of our gothometer.
True, true.
Because in Chamber of Secrets, it's much more in a way like the secret, the castle, the secret, you know, chamber, like very kind of old school 13th century gothic, whereas Prisoner of Azkaban, just the essence of the Dementor is that sort of supernatural, in a sense, a more modern horror sense of gothic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, excellent point.
So, yeah, but of course, gothic winner of the week, how could it not be the Dementor?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Alrighty then, and so I picked the card at random for tarot of the day.
Cool.
And so I ended up picking the Five of Swords.
Five of Swords. Now, swords are usually
we discussed this, you know, they can be right. Air or fire.
Okay. I like kind of the what they deal with typically in tarot, like cups, usually emotion.
Yeah. And they're the opposite where swords are very much intellect.
Intellect. Okay. Mm-hmm. I believe this is not a card that you would necessarily want to pull in a reading.
Yeah. It's not wholly positive. The Five of Swords turns up when you have a falling out, disagreement or conflict, and you are walking away with a sense of sadness and loss. You may be upset and resentful over the heated words you said and now wish you could talk back. Bad blood and a general ickiness hang over you as your relations have turned sour.
So a Dementor, like the general ickiness hanging over you, feels like that's a Dementor floating on by.
So for me, what I got out of, you know, the sort of like conflict or disagreement is, again, Ron and Hermione butting heads because Hermione has valid points about divination, but a big chunk of it is she just doesn't want to admit that she's not going to be good at something and she's not going to be intuitively the best person in the class.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see where her relationship with how her relationship with divination develops or if she retains that prejudice throughout the series. I don't know. I'm very curious because I don't think I've encountered many things that Hermione isn't just super excited to know something about. You know, they kind of rib her for wanting to know the history of muggles, being like, aren't your parents muggles? And she's like, yeah, but I'd be curious as to, you know, blah, blah, blah. So this is kind of the weird divination is her reaction is interesting.
Yeah. The advice of the Five of Swords is to pick your battles. You may be tempted to fight at every conflict to ensure you get your way, to prove that you are right, or defend yourself when you are feeling challenged or threatened. However, most experts agree choosing your battles wisely is much better way of life than engaging in every disagreement. Not only will it lead to a more peaceful existence, but your interpersonal relationships are likely to come out stronger.
So that kind of begs the question with Ron and Hermione's little tiff, you know, is that really the biggest thing is it really worth
it? On?
Right.
Yeah. And one way I thought about it was also, you know, Malfoy assessing, because it could have happened in a variety of ways. Either Malfoy did not listen to Hagrid just at all and honestly did not hear the instruction, don't insult them. And mm-hmm. he just acted his normal self and that incident occurred. Or it could be that Malfoy heard it and deliberately did it, wanting to get Hagrid in trouble and not fully, but still in a childish way, not fully assessing what this huge bird horse could do to him.
That's an excellent thought. And I do believe Malfoy is that manipulative. So
by the extension, you know, picking your battles, like, again, was it worth, you know, getting your arm slashed? Yes, the Mediwitch can fix it up. Like, but was getting Hagrid in trouble worth that price?
I'm sure to Malfoy it was, because he just doesn't like Hagrid at all and thinks he's ridiculous. So, but I think, is it worth it? I don't know. I don't think it's going to be successful given Dumbledore and Hagrid's relationship, but he tried, I guess.
Yeah. The Five of Swords may also point to failure. It shows that despite your best efforts, you are likely to be beaten or come out as the loser. Yeah, that makes me think of poor Hagrid and how he's feeling about how could his first class go so, so wrong.
I know, of course. I just feel like that's just kind of Hagrid's fate sometimes. He's just kind of, he's got a good heart and has a rough time.
And it says that this is his very first class of the week. Because so, like, again, he's teaching third years and above. So he's got, like, at least 8 classes.
Too bad. Poor Hagrid with, like, you know, having to deal with Malfoy. I'm sure, you know, Hagrid and Malfoy have butted heads before. So I'm sure he... You know, I guess you can't be like, I can't have this particular student in my class. I don't know. I'm not a teacher.
Yeah, it would have been nicer if this had happened later in the semester and Hagrid could have made the case that, look, I have other students dealing with, you know, griffins or dragons or like crazy venomous snakes, like, and none of them choose to be an idiot the way this kid chose to be an idiot.
Right.
But the fact that it was the very first class, you know, and he doesn't have that buildup of that rapport with his students or his, you know, his teaching reputation yet.
Right.
But.
Oh, poor Hagrid.
Poor Hagrid. Yep. And so now it is time for the rune of the day. And so I picked it, and it was actually the rune that looks like the X.
Okay.
And let me pull up a little definition. It's called Gebo, which is.
Oh, interesting.
The 7th rune is Gebo, which corresponds to the G sound in the Latin alphabet. Gebo is positive rune in most cases, suggesting gifts and partnerships that are usually beneficial. When I see Gebo in a casting, it usually influences the casting in a positive way, where even so-called negative runes may lead up to something good, especially Gebo is the future outcome spot. Gebo in Old Norse is... Gar. Gebo is the rune of generosity and giving. Our ancestors often gave gifts in exchange for partnerships, so Gebo is also the rune of beneficial partnerships. It represents a gift for a gift, whether the gifts are aid, work, or an actual gift. When gifts are exchanged, the gift creates a relationship between the two parties.
So before you started getting in there, and when you mentioned gift, I was thinking of Professor Trelawney and her gift of being able to, you know, have the sight and read tea leaves and things like that. So I, that was kind of my initial thought. Yeah,
well, but in Trelawney's case, like, she's kind of using the capital gift.
Yes.
When I thought about it, and it's sort of both a gift and just forging relationships, the gift of chocolate from Professor Lupin.
Oh, that's very nice. Yes, that's a very, and it was a very helpful gift for everybody. Though it's kind of fun. I mean, and I'm sure that's kind of why it happened, to push chocolate on kids, you know, who are like, of course.
Yeah, that ain't too hard. And right. Also gifts, as, and again, you're aware from pop culture, we don't know it officially at this time, but this is when Professor McGonagall gifts the time turner to Hermione.
Yes. That's their kind of little secret they worked it. So, yeah.
Yeah, but gifts and forging relation, and just by the extension of the gift forging relationships is, you know, giving a time turner to a 13-year-old, like, McGonagall would have had to pull quite a few strings, I think, for as phenomenal as Hermione is.
And I feel it's a slightly irresponsible because
yeah, we'll get into like whether it was purely responsible for her even to suggest it for a 13-year-old. But the fact is that their relationship is growing, and in giving Hermione this gift, you know, McGonagall is securing her position as an advocate for Hermione.
Yeah, which that's cool. That's nice, and she probably sees herself in Hermione, which is
alrighty then. And then we have our last exercise, fan fiction time.
Oh man, these chapters were so full. It's almost like...
I know. It's like again, it's been an hour and a half.
Right. I'm just going to just take it. I feel like this is an easy one, but what if Hermione was actually really excited about divination and really wanted to know everything and kind of fully embraced? It would be like a kind of a quirk and contradictory to all of her, you know, very A plus B equals C logical thinking, but she just was really fascinated by divination. I think that would have been that to the point where people were surprised. I don't know. That's when I'm.
Yeah, because I've met people like that where like in their jobs or like in, you know, their just social circle, like they totally appear this one way and every other way, but they have this little quirk that people are like, really?
Yeah.
So yeah. If Hermione would embrace divination, yeah, I think for Hermione, again, I don't know how you can do it without disrupting a great deal of her personality, but she could have approached it as, okay, I'm already doing a lot of deeply analytical magical subjects like arithmancy and ancient runes, and that fulfills my deeply neurotic analytical side, and then I'll have this one class where it's just more go with the flow and trust, you know, trust what comes to mind. Like, I have my other classes to fulfill my neurotic side. I can have this one class where it's just okay, whatever, but she can't let it go.
Yeah, that's too bad. I think that would have been a fun like way to take that storyline. But yeah, that was my thought for the fan fiction. What about you?
Yeah, oh no, I'm just thinking about yours again. What if it secretly came out that Hermione was a seer?
Then she would be that much more powerful, I think. I mean, she's already very powerful in her ways, and especially her ability to retain information, all of this stuff. So that's just like, man, she would be, I can't imagine right now with how her rejection of it is so fascinating to me at this point, that her embracing of it would be, I think, equally as fascinating. If she just kind of treated it like another class, it would be okay, whatever, you know, she wants to be the A student, but to have her be enthusiastic about it would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. I had two fanfic what ifs. What if Harry had taken really ill by the Dementors?
Oh, like in the hospital wing for months?
Like not months, but maybe like a few days. Like what if he was significantly impacted? Because I'm not just thinking, oh, like at a kid level, that, you know, Draco Malfoy would have bullied him more. Draco was going to bully him no matter what or no matter how bad it got. But what would it say to the ministry that the guy that the Dementors are looking for would put them at the school to protect the kid and they've incapacitated the kid?
Yeah, that would, I think Dumbledore would have felt super justified in his irritation of them there. And then they, I'm sure, would have felt very befuddled by, you know, oh, whoops, kind of. I mean, that would be very interesting because that's the last thing anybody in this world wants to do is screw up Harry Potter's life. I mean, you know, of the normies. Yeah, except Snape and a bunch of other people. But I'm like thinking the common wizard, I guess, doesn't want anything bad to happen to whole Harry Potter. So that would be interesting. It would take the, because you kind of wonder what would happen with the magical creatures class. I almost think that, you know, Malfoy, that probably would have played out the same, but maybe in a little bit more arrogance and trying to flex and be cool. I don't know.
Yeah. And then my other what if the Malfoy / Buckbeak incident could have been avoided?
Like if Malfoy just basically was paid attention and didn't go up and insult Buckbeak, or just that he was removed from the class entirely.
Or at least just Malfoy was not given the opportunity to you know, just be his normal shitty self.
I feel like that would be coming at some point.
Malfoy, yeah, like I feel it could only be delayed, never fully eliminated.
I think, yeah, he would have found another magical creature to antagonize and to make Hagrid look bad.
You know, and by posing this, I'm just thinking, again, Care of Magical Creatures is an elective. Malfoy didn't have to be here. And especially, the way he thinks of whether he heard it or not, calling Buckbeak an ugly brute, clearly, you know, had his history with Dobby as the family house elf and thinking lesser than. Why would he, of all people, give a crap about magical creatures? He barely treats muggleborns as human. So why would he deal with magical animals?
I wonder if it's just he just wants to antagonize Hagrid. Like, some people are that weird and disgusting. And I don't think very highly of Malfoy right now. And I know I'm not supposed to, but I can't, you know, get into his redeeming qualities at this point. But I feel like he's almost like, cool, I want to, he's like that kind of bully. Like, he's just like, this will be fun, is to antagonize this, you know, half giant, basically.
Yeah. And also I think it's part of, it's like the why I don't like hunting, really, because I feel like some people, when it comes to like hunting, it's all about the ego alpha. Oh, I'm such a tough guy. I can go out and shoot this elk.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I'm, and it's true. Like, even we have a certain, you know, perception of Ron's brother, Charlie, who deals with dragons. And we think he's such a badass because he works with dragons. And so I think by extension, on a smaller scale, in Draco's mind, you know, being able to tame wild creatures is a means of social capital to be the quote unquote alpha male in this toxic masculinity crap.
I think that is exactly what it is. He's just purely doing it, not out of actual interest, but just to be a jerk.
Mm. Alrighty then, and that concludes two jam-packed chapters of Prisoner of Azkaban. Tune in next time and we will go over chapters 7 and 8, The Boggart in the Wardrobe and The Flight of the Fat Lady. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.